Chapter 60. Pitt was certain he was dead. There was no reason why he shouldn't be dead. And yet he saw no blinding light at the end of a tunnel, no faces of friends and relatives who died before him. He felt as though he were dozing in his own bed at home. And Lauren was there, her hair cascading on the pillow, her body pressed against his, her arms encircling his neck, holding tightly, refusing to let him drift away. Her face seemed to glow, and her violet eyes looked straight into his. He wondered if she was dead, too. Suddenly she released her hold and began to blur, moving away, diminishing ever smaller until she vanished altogether. A dim light filtered through his closed eyelids, and he heard voices in the distance. Slowly, with an effort as great as lifting a pair of 100-pound weights, he opened his eyes. At first he thought he was gazing at a flat white surface. Then, as his mind crept past the veil of unconsciousness, he realized he really was gazing at a flat white surface. It was a ceiling. A strange voice said, "He's coming around. Takes more than 3 cracked ribs, a brain concussion, and a gallon of seawater to do this character in." There was no mistaking this laconic voice. "My worst fears," Pitt managed to mutter. "I've gone to hell and met the devil." "See how he talks about his best and only friend," said Al Giordino to a doctor in naval uniform. "He's in good physical shape," said the doctor. "He should mend pretty quickly." "Pardon the mundane question," said Pitt, "but where am I?" "Welcome to the U.S. Naval Hospital at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba," the doctor answered. "You and Mr. Giordino were fished out of the water by one of our recovery craft." Pitt focused his eyes on Giordino. "Are you all right?" "He has a bruise the size of a cantaloupe on his abdomen, but he'll survive," the doctor said, smiling. "By the way, I understand he saved your life." Pitt cleared the mist from his mind and tried to recall. "The steward from the Leonid Andreev was playing baseball with my head." "Pounded you under the boat with an oar," Giordino explained. "I slipped over the side, swam underwater until I grabbed your arm and dragged you to the surface. The steward would have beat on me, too, except for the timely arrival of a Navy helicopter whose paramedics jumped into the water and helped sling us on board." "And Lauren?" Giordino averted his gaze. "She's listed as missing." "Missing hell," Pitt snarled. He grimaced from the sudden pain in his chest as he rose to his elbows. "We both know she was alive and sitting in the lifeboat." A solemn look clouded Giordino's face. "Her name didn't appear on a list of survivors given out by the ship's captain." "A Bougainville ship," Pitt blurted as his memory came flooding back. "The Oriental steward who tried to brain us pointed toward the Chalmette," Giordino prompted. "Yes, the Chalmette, and said it belonged to him. He also spoke my name." "Stewards are supposed to remember passengers' names. He knew you as Charlie Gruber in cabin 34. "No, he rightly accused me of meddling in Bougainville affairs, and his last words were, 'Bon voyage, Dirk Pitt.'" Giordino gave a puzzled shrug. "Beats hell out of me how he knew you. But why would a Bougainville man work as a steward on a Russian cruise ship?" "I can't begin to guess." "And lie about Lauren's rescue." Pitt merely gave an imperceptible shake of his head. "Then she's being held prisoner by the Bougainville," said Giordino, as if suddenly enlightened. "But for what reason?" "You keep asking questions I can't answer," Pitt said irritably. "Where is the Chalmette now?" "Headed toward Miami to land the survivors." "How long have I been unconscious?" "About 32 hours, replied the doctor. "Still time," said Pitt. "The Chalmette won't reach the Florida coast for several hours yet." He raised himself to a sitting position and swung his legs over the side of the bed. The room began to seesaw back and forth. The doctor moved forward and steadied him by both arms. "I hope you don't think you're rushing off somewhere." "I intend to be standing on the dock when the Chalmette arrives in Miami," Pitt said implacably. A stern medical profession look grew on the doctor's face. "You're staying in this bed for the next 4 days. You can't travel around with those fractured ribs, and we don't know how serious your concussion is." "Sorry, Doc," Giordino said, "but you've both been overruled." Pitt stared at him stonily. "Who's to stop me?" "Admiral Sandecker, for one. Secretary of State Doug Oates, for another," Giordino answered as detachedly as though he were reading aloud the stock market quotes for the day. "Orders came down for you to fly to Washington the minute you came around. We may be in big trouble." I have a hunch we dipped into the wrong cookie jar when we discovered Congressman Moran and Senator Larimer imprisoned on a Soviet vessel. They can wait until I search the Chalmette for Lauren. My job. You go to the Capitol while I go to Miami and play customs inspector. It's all been arranged. Pacified to a small degree, Pitt relaxed on the bed. What about Moran?
He couldn't wait to cut out, Giordino said angrily. He demanded the Navy drop everything and fly him home the minute he was brought ashore. I had a minor confrontation with him in the hospital corridor after his routine examination. Came within a millimeter of cramming his hooked nose down his gullet. The bastard didn't demonstrate the slightest concern about Lauren, and he seemed downright delighted when I told him of Larimer's death.
He has a talent for deserting those who help him, Pitt said disgustedly. An orderly rolled in a wheelchair, and together with Giordino eased Pitt into it. A groan escaped his lips as a piercing pain ripped through his chest. You're leaving against my express wishes, said the doctor. I want that understood. There is no guarantee you won't have complications if you overtax yourself.
I release you from all responsibility, Doc, Pitt said, smiling. I won't tell a soul I was your patient. Your medical reputation is secure.
Giordino laid a pile of Navy-issue clothing and a small paper sack in Pitt's lap. Here's some presentable clothes and the stuff from your pockets. You can dress on the plane to save time. Pitt opened the sack and fingered a vinyl pouch inside. Satisfied the contents were secure and dry, he looked up at Giordino and shook hands.
Good hunting, friend.
Giordino patted him on the shoulder.
Don't worry, I'll find her. You go to Washington and give 'em hell.
No one could have suffered from a Rip Van Winkle syndrome and awakened more surprised than Alan Moran. He remembered going to sleep on the presidential yacht almost 2 weeks earlier, and his next conscious sensation was being dragged into a limousine somewhere in the river country of South Carolina. The imprisonment and escape from the burning Russian cruise ship seemed a distorted blur. Only when he returned to Washington and found both Congress and the Supreme Court evicted from their hallowed halls did he come back on track and retrieve his mantle of political power. With the government in emotional and political shambles, he saw his chance to fulfill his deep, unfathomable ambition to become president. Not having the popular support to take the office by election, he was determined now to grab it by default. With Margolin missing, Larimer out of the way, and the president laid open for impeachment, there was little to stop him. Moran held court in the middle of Jackson Square across Pennsylvania Avenue from the White House and answered questions fired by a battery of correspondents. He was the man of the hour and was enjoying every second of the attention.
"Can you tell us where you've been the last 2 weeks?" asked Ray Marsh of the New York Times.
"Be glad to," Moran replied gracefully. "Senate Majority Leader Marcus Larimer and I went on a fishing holiday in the Caribbean, partly to try our luck at snagging a record marlin, mostly to discuss the issues facing our great nation. Initial reports state that Senator Larimer died during the Leonid Andreev tragedy."
"I'm deeply saddened to say that is true," Moran said, abruptly becoming solemn. "The senator and I were trolling only 5 or 6 miles away from the Russian cruise ship when we heard and observed an explosion that covered her in fire and smoke. We immediately ordered our skipper to change course for the disaster area. When we arrived, the Leonid Andreev was ablaze from stem to stern. Hundreds of frightened passengers were tumbling into the sea, many with their clothes in flames."
Moran paused for effect and then enunciated in a vivid, descriptive tone. "I leaped into the water, followed by the senator, to help those who were badly injured or unable to swim. We struggled for what seemed like hours, keeping women and children afloat until we could lift them into our fishing boat. I lost track of Senator Larimer. When I looked for him, he was floating face down, an apparent victim of a heart attack due to overexertion. You can quote me as saying he died a real hero."
"How many people do you reckon you saved?" This from Joe Stark of the United Press.
"I lost count," answered Moran, serenely pitching out the lies. "Our small vessel became dangerously overloaded with burned and half-drowned victims. So, rather than become the straw that might capsize it, so to speak, I remained in the water so one more pitiful creature could cheat death. Luckily for me, I was picked up by the Navy, which, I must add, performed magnificently."
"Were you aware that Congresswoman Lauren Smith was traveling on the Leonid Andreev?" asked Marion Ternier of the Associated Press Radio Network.
"Not at the time," replied Moran, changing back to his solemn demeanor again.
Regretfully, I've only just been informed that she's reported as missing.
Curtis Mayo signaled his cameraman and edged closer to Moran.
Congressman, what is your feeling regarding the President's unprecedented closing of Congress?
Deeply mortified that such an arrogant deed could take place in our government. It's obvious the President has taken leave of his senses. With one terrible blow, he has swept our nation from a democracy into a fascist state. I fully intend to see that he is removed from office. The sooner the better.
How do you propose to do it? Mayo pushed him. Every time the members of the House convene to launch impeachment proceedings, the President sends in troops to disband them.
The story will be different this time, Moran said confidently. Tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, members of Congress will hold a joint session in Listener Auditorium at George Washington University. And in order to meet without interference or disruption by the President's unauthorized and immoral use of the military, we intend to confront force with force. I have conferred with my House and Senate colleagues from the neighboring states of Maryland and Virginia, who have prevailed upon their governors to protect our constitutional right to assemble by providing troops from their National Guard units.
Will they have orders to shoot? Asked Mayo, smelling newsworthy blood.
If attacked, Moran replied coldly, the answer is an absolute yes.
And so Civil War II erupts, said Oates wearily, as he switched off the TV set and turned to face Emmett, Mercier, and Brogan.
Moran is as daft as the President, Emmett said, shaking his head in disgust.
I pity the American public for being forced to accept such miserable leadership material, Mercier grumbled.
How do you read the upcoming confrontation at Listener Auditorium, Oates asked Emmett.
The special forces of Army and Marines patrolling Capitol Hill are highly trained professionals. They can be counted on to stand firm and not attempt anything stupid. The National Guard is the real danger. All it takes is one weekend warrior to panic and fire off a round. Then we'll witness another Kent State bloodbath, except much worse. This time the Guard will have their fire returned by deadly marksmen.
The situation won't be helped if a few congressmen fall in the crossfire, added Mercier.
The President has to be isolated. The timetable must be moved up, said Oates.
Mercier looked unsold.
That means cutting back Dr. Edgley's evaluation of the President's brain signals.
Preventing wholesale slaughter must take priority over a plan to mislead the Russians, said Oates.
Brogan gazed at the ceiling thoughtfully.
I think we might steal our chicken and pluck it, too.
Oates smiled.
I hear the gears meshing in your head, Martin. What wild Machiavellian scheme has the CIA got up its sleeve now?
A way to give Edgley an advantage, answered Brogan with a fox-like grin.
A little something borrowed from the Twilight Zone.